Okay, can we welcome back the members and also competition tribunal for the leadership of Mr. Manon. Welcome you and thank you for availing yourself to work on the committee. This is a continuation of our meeting, and none of you is new. You all know the members here, and none of us are new, or except Mr. Bobaza, I think. Did you interact with the tribunal before? No, for the first time, yeah. That's our new member, Mr. Bobaza. Yes, who joined us, I think, in the course of the year. Okay. Otherwise, thank you very much for coming, and we're looking forward to your presentation. May we, without a waste of time, hand over to you for the presentation on the annual report.
Chair, good afternoon. Good afternoon, members. It's a great pleasure to be with you again. Just to introduce ourselves again, I'm the chairperson of the tribunal. On my left is Lorata Motuong, the registrar, and on my far left is Janine de Klerk, who's head of our corporate services, which entails finances and human resources and information technology. This is our annual report for 2010 and 2011. So I can probably just take you back onto our third slide there. What do we do? And just as a reminder, what do we do? We are essentially the court of the competition authorities. We regulate mergers and adjudicate anti-competitive practices. So that's our core business. In respect of mergers, we can authorize or prohibit large mergers. And we also hear appeals from the Commission's decision on what are called intermediate mergers, because there are some mergers that the Commission itself can decide upon, and people want to appeal against them. They come to us with that sort of case. Next heading is restrictive practices, and these are cartel cases, abuse of dominance cases. Here we are the court, in a sense, in the classic sense. And we adjudicate three types of procedures here. Firstly, we have the actual contested complaint referral case. In other words, people come along with the traditional case. The commission says, these people are a cartel. The respondents may say, we're not a cartel, or yes, we were, but much less of a cartel than you think they are. We act as the court in that case. Secondly, we also adjudicate what are called interim relief applications. These also involve restrictive practices, but under interim relief, we are able to give temporary relief for a few months at a time when the Commission is still investigating the case. The third is that we can adjudicate appeals from the Competition Commission's decision regarding applications for exemptions. And thus far, in 12 years, we actually haven't had a year of one of those appeals, so that's an area that we haven't been involved in at all, but recently there has been a big exemption involving the petroleum industry, so it'll be interesting if anybody has an objection to that and comes to us with that. But that exemption is granted by the Commission, not by us. We only hear appeals. Then if I just go through some of the highlights of this particular year, we heard 116 cases, and that includes mergers and the restrictive practices. We issue reasons for all our cases, and there were 74 reasons issued. Why is there a discrepancy between those numbers? That's because simply at the end of the year, some cases are still out for decision, and that's why there's a slight discrepancy. Then in terms of our turnaround times, 86% of hearings in large merger cases took place within 10 days of receipt of the case. The reason that we monitor 10 days is our rules require us to set down a hearing for a merger within 10 days or a pre-hearing into that merger, and we try to achieve around 80% for that. So we've met our target. That 100% of the decisions in large merger cases released within 10 days of the hearing. Again, the 10-day period is set down in our rules. And then there's a final figure saying 107 days spent in hearings. Our core business is spending time in hearings, and that's the number of hearing days which we've had per year. This is another statistic which breaks down the matters that I've given you into their different types. You'll see that we heard 55 large mergers, and in the period we gave 51 decisions. Procedural matters, there were 30 of them, and we gave 16 reasons during that period. Intermediate mergers, those are the mergers that the commission decides, we only heard one of them on the appeal. So in other words, you'll see from that the bulk of merger work we do by far are large mergers. Then we get to the complaint referrals. Those are really restrictive practice cases. Here the bulk again is consent orders, and let me just explain what they are. But you'll see a breakdown between consent orders and opposed referrals. Basically, what happens is that a complaint referral relates to a restrictive practice case, in other words, a complaint about a cartel or abuse of dominance. As in criminal activity, the party could either litigate the matter before us, in which case we have what we call an opposed matter, and in other words, a trial is run before us and we decide who is right or wrong, and if somebody has been found to contravene the law, we decide on a remedy. But parties also allowed to plea bargain, as they do in criminal law. In other words, they're allowed to reach agreement amongst themselves. And our job then is, and they call that a consent order. In other words, they agree that the firm has contravened the law, and they agree on a remedy, which can be a fine and sometimes may not be a fine. Simply to desist from a particular practice or to divest of a particular company. I'll later deal with some examples of that in practice that we've had this year. And you'll see that by far the majority of the restrictive practice cases land up in consent orders. And so I can ask the question, is this a good thing or a bad thing that they land up in that particular way? And I want to suggest, even at the detriment of my institution's efforts, that it's a good thing that the Commission and parties reach a consent order agreement for a number of reasons. One is that the matter is resolved much more quickly than would if there was a closed hearing, because they can sometimes, soon after the Commission investigates the complaint, they can reach a consent order. Not always, but there's no doubt that it resolves the matter much more quickly than it was in opposed litigation. And secondly, that state resources and private resources on fighting court cases, these cases are incredibly expensive to run, are not wasted by an opposed proceeding. And third, in a sense, there's some virtue in people agreeing a remedy than having it imposed upon them outside. So I think. So I think it's good that this is happening. I think it's a healthy statistic, and hopefully it will continue. The next column there deals with complaint referrals from a complaint, and there is one case there. Just to explain what that means. Under our system, the Commission is the official and preferred prosecutor of restrictive practice cases, but we also have what criminal law will call the sort of nolle prosequi, which is a situation where the state decides not to prosecute somebody and then says to the private party who complained of that conduct, you can take, we don't think there's a case here, but if you wish to prosecute the case, you may do so. And our system recognizes that private complainants can, if the commission doesn't want to take the case, bring the case themselves. Those cases are not that frequent, and you'll see from that statistic that is fairly typical. That they aren't that often. Most of the cases come via the commission. But occasionally a private complainant will bring a complaint themselves under their own resources. It is very expensive for them to do so, and if they would fail, they would often have a cost order against them. So it's usually only a well-resourced private complainant that can do that. Next column is interim relief matters, and those are the matters that I explained earlier, where a matter is being investigated by the commission. It can sometimes take a long time for the commission to investigate matters. The Act allows them typically a period of 1 year. And it may be that the business who is the victim of that restrictive practice is suffering harm, and so it wants urgent relief. And the Act recognizes by granting them the right to apply for interim relief to us and we can give an order that is of 6 months duration. Now, interim relief is quite difficult because in competition cases, the facts are quite complex, and so it's quite difficult for people to establish in a short duration, in an urgent application, the necessary complexity of facts to favour their case. And secondly, not all relief is suited to a six-month period of relief, which can then be terminated. So interim relief cases are perhaps less frequent than we would like them to be, but they are still a possibility open to the private complainant. Generally, if you looked at our statistics, people who brought interim relief cases have not been that successful, and sometimes when they've been successful before us, they've appealed, and the appeal has been overturned. So it is a remedy available to people, but frankly, it hasn't been of great utility in competition cases. Move on then to our next slide. Here we deal with large mergers in slightly more detail. Again, just to remind you that large mergers are the mergers that the Commission investigates and makes a recommendation, but the Tribunal itself makes a decision. So the well-known Walmart matter, which you're all familiar with from your hearings, was an example of a large merger where the Commission had made a recommendation, and the matter was then taken to the Tribunal for a hearing and consideration. What this first slide does is just to give you a breakdown of the numbers of mergers that we've had since 1999 until 2010-11. And you'll see how we start off slowly and had a great spike in sort of 2008 and 2009, and how that has gone down greatly in 2009-10. There's slightly increased in 2010-11. And it's really, I suppose, a reflection of economic activity itself. In other words, when the economy is healthy, more people are taking risks. Taking risks, they merge, and that's an indication somehow of the economy's health. We probably lag the economy by about a year. In other words, deals get formalized, but by the time they come to us for decision, it's about a year later. So sort of 2008 and 9 looks very healthy here. We know it wasn't so healthy. The reason for that is that probably reflects deals made the year before. And the reason 9-10 and 10-11 look so unhealthy is that we're still probably seeing those effects of 2008 and 2009. They lag slightly. But there's a slight uptake in 2010-11, not noticeable, but it's hopefully a sign that things are improving. Our sense is that in this current year that we are seeing a lot more mergers. It doesn't mean that every merger itself is an example of a healthy economy. Sometimes mergers themselves are rescues by wealthier firms of troubled firms. If I can then go into the next slide, this slide gives you a feel for, because it's quite useful to understand our next slide, is that of the mergers that we hear, 90% over the 10-year period have been approved without any conditions. In other words, people have got the green light and told to go ahead. 8% have been approved subject to conditions. And when I say conditions, it means that there is a problem with the Commission. It's problematic in terms of the competition itself, issues themselves, an anti-competitive effect, or it offends against the public interest. The Walmart case, which you've known again, was essentially about public interest issues. Now, we can impose conditions that either address the detrimental anti-competitive effect or a detrimental detriment to the public interest, usually which is related to employment. So those 8% would reflect cases where there'd been a negative effect either to the competitiveness of the economy created by the merger or the public interest, and hence conditions were imposed. Occasionally, however, you're faced with a merger that can't be resurrected by conditions, and therefore it's appropriate to actually prohibit that merger. And you'll see that over the 10-year period, only 1% of the mergers, 8 in total, have actually been prohibited. So there's a very small number of mergers that actually get prohibited. And if we can just compare that to the current year, if we can just go to the next slide, you'll see that we're more, this is just for the last 2010-2011. We heard 54 mergers, and of them, 94% approved unconditionally, and 5.5 were approved conditions. 5.5 is not a very useful statistic. It was 3 that were produced subject to conditions. So if we just go back to the previous slide, you'll see that we're more or less in the ballpark. We didn't have any prohibitions this year, and we had slightly less subject to conditions, but we were more there and thereabouts up to our 10-year trend, with slightly less problematic mergers in this particular merger. Sorry, in this particular financial year. If we can then go on to our next slide, and we'll look at these are 3 cases that we thought were of interest in this particular year. If I might just mention them, the Metropolitan Holdings and Momentum one we discussed previously in this committee, and that's just to remind you, merger of 2 large insurance groups, and there's going to be a possible loss of 1,000 jobs as a result of that. The trade union representing the employees, or some of them, had contested a commission condition which allowed only for retraining and put a ceiling of 1,000 retrenchments. We heard the matter, and we heard it over a number of days, and we came to the conclusion that the rationale for retrenching 1,000 people had not actually been adequately motivated by the firm. And so we put a moratorium on retrenchments for a period of 2 years, other than senior management people. And we set out, what's more important in the case than the result itself, was that we set out our approach to employment loss in mergers in more detail than we had before. And essentially what we held was that the firms themselves, when there is a substantial number of retrenchments, should justify why they're taking place. In other words, what is the reason for that? And in assessing that, we would look at whether look at it through the competition lens. Were the retrenchments simply to make shareholders rich, or were they justified by some broader public interest to make the firms more competitive, to rescue a failing firm, etc., etc.? In other words, we said it's perfectly acceptable if a firm is in trouble that retrenchments may need to take place. Or it may be that the firm is the target firm is not competitive at current levels and needs to reduce expenses, and that employment loss might be justified to bring down the running cost of that firm. And generally speaking, the importance of that case was the approach that we've taken. We've taken it in subsequent cases. The AECI Quemico case was also related to employment conditions. They were actually agreed to between the commission and the firms. And largely, there, the conditions were slightly different. They regarded people were retrenched. It seemed that the retrenchments were acceptably motivated, that the firms had agreed to a retraining program, and that was made a condition to the approval of the merger. And finally, Unilever and Sara Lee involved a large international merger between these two makers of fast-moving consumer goods, and a condition was imposed relating to the sale of a brand, and that was the Status deodorant brand. So that was a condition imposed on competition ground. Again, there was largely consensus between the party itself and the commission in having that condition.
Before you continue, is it possible to clarify what do you mean by reasons issued?
Okay. Let me explain the way our merger process works is it's premised on urgency. We must bring out we must try and get these cases resolved as soon as possible, because there's a tension between people who want to do a deal and the state's interest, public interest in seeing that deals don't either harm the competition fabric or the public interest. So the regulators need some time to look at this transaction and decide whether it's okay or not, but the firms have a contrary interest in trying to get the deal done. So we lay down periods and procedures to try and balance that interest. So what we do is we say that we will give an order, we'll decide whether the merger should be approved
prohibited or subject to conditions within 10 days of the end of the hearing. And that's what we call our order. We then say, we're obliged and law to explain our order. In other words, why did you come to that order? Why did you prohibit that merger? And we're obliged to bring our reasons out within 20 days of giving our order. And hence the distinction between what we call our order, approved, prohibited, or conditionally approved, and the reasons for giving that order. If we can then just deal with two other mergers that came up this year, which was with two different outcomes, just to give you a feel for what sort of happens in the in tribunal hearings. The Tsocho Sun Holdings and Gold Reefs Resorts was a merger between two groups which own a number of casinos, and the commission had decided to approve this merger subject to condition that the merging firms sell off a casino called Silver Lakes, which is near Krugersdorp. And the concern was that because the combined groups would have several of the Gauteng-based licenses, because they would own Gold Reef City, Silver Lakes, and Monte Casino, this would be anti-competitive. The merging parties opposed this and said the merger should be approved without conditions. And there was quite a long proceeding as to whether how competition exists in the casino industry and whether casinos compete with one another or they compete with other leisure activity. And eventually, after quite a long hearing, we cleared the merger without conditions. In other words, we the merging parties were successful, the commission wasn't. We felt the divestiture hadn't been justified. And we made the point that we felt that the way the evidence had been run by both parties had not done the process much justice, because we had very little consumer evidence. Perhaps because it was a casino merger that consumers were not coming forward to put their hands up and saying, I'm a consumer of these services. But that merger was approved, and we somehow came down for neither the merging party's theory that all leisure activities compete with one another, nor for the commission's suggested condition that we sell off Silver Lakes. The merger has gone ahead without the condition being opposed. The next merger, I just wanted to give you a different example of, so in other words, that's an example of a merger where there is, in a sense, litigation conflict between the parties, which we have to decide. The Bedrock Mining Support and Mondi Limited merger was a merger between companies that make mining supports. In other words, these are these wooden structures that are put into mining to put in mines to make them safe. And the commission had initially recommended the merger be approved subject to a divestiture condition, which required divestiture. One company owned forests as well as having the structural support business. The merging parties opposed the condition. And there were two third parties who had their own take on this matter as well. And what happened is that the matter started before the tribunal. Within a day of the hearings and some witnesses being called, a settlement was reached between the commission and the parties and also between the third parties. And so we had an outcome which everybody agreed to, but which was different to the commission's initial outcome. And in a sense, what it does is not so much that the tribunal itself came to a grand conclusion having heard the case. There's an example that having a different forum there allowed people, which required people to justify either their merger or their opposition to it, created a condition which people came to a settlement of quite a complicated matter in quite a useful way, because they realized there was an incentive to settle because we could have come up with a solution that perhaps nobody liked. I'm just saying it as a devil's advocate thing. But the useful nature of the tribunal as a second take is because it allows sometimes complex matters which have to be sorted out very quickly in the commission's procedures, because when the commission decides an intermediate merger, there's only 40 days to reach a conclusion. Quite often that's not sufficient to deal with a complex matter. So having this second take at the tribunal's proceedings in our system leads to, in a sense, a better outcome sometimes for everybody. It doesn't necessarily happen all the time. but allows for that possibility, and in that sense is quite useful. So although the facts of bedrock mining and Mondi themselves are not that interesting, it's the use of the process that does make it, and that you get an outcome that everybody then agrees with, and that we were then able to make an order subject to conditions that met, in this case, both a competition concern raised by the Commission, a supply concern raised by a third party who was a rival to the merging firm, and a public interest concern raised by a small BE firm that thought its supply was going to run out. So all these two firms were opposing were given a contract which was made a condition to the merger. Significance of that is that if the contract is breached, it's not only a breach of contract, but it's also a breach of the merger condition. So in a sense, ups the incentives of the merged firm to, in a sense, comply with the contract. Then if I can go on to the next matter, this is really just our turnaround times to mergers. This is a statistic that relates to our performance.
Sorry about that. I would like to apologize for the chairperson. She has been taken by an agent matter. She requested that I continue in her place to chair the meeting. So if the apology is accepted, can we continue?
Thanks very much. On this particular slide, we deal with turnaround times for mergers. One of the difficulties for us is that we're obliged to report on our performance. And because we are an independent body, it would compromise our independence if we were to give a statistic saying that we will stop 10 mergers a year, or we will fine, set as a target how much money we will fine firms. We can't have a priori predetermined outcome. So in dealing with the sort of the Auditor General staff, the people who are interested in these figures, we said, look, what we should be able to do is to indicate our performance in terms of how quickly do we do our job, how efficient are we. And in a sense, we've developed targets around that. So this is our performance around mergers. I indicated to you earlier that we want to set down mergers within 10 days of them being referred to us by the Commission. So there you will see that 49 out of 52 were heard within 10 days of the referral of the Commission. That out of all of them, we decided the outcome within 10 days of the hearing. And Chair, that's your question about the order. That would be the order has been given within the 10 days. And then the reasons, to separate the reasons from the order, 30 out of 51 had been issued within the 20 days of decision. Now, our performance requires us to make, our rules require them to be done within 20 days of the decision. Why is the performance so far short of the requirement? That's about less than 60%. So you might say that's not a very good statistic. Correct, it's not a good statistic. But most of the mergers you will see from the previous slide, 90% of them are approved without conditions. And what happens is that we have a policy of prioritization in writing reasons. We give reasons early which are going to be adverse to some party because they might wish to appeal us, or there might be a condition. And so what happens is that 90% of mergers that are uncontested are pushed. We take up, if you want to borrow from the medical industry, a triage approach. We put them at the back of the emergency room and say, look, we'll decide the other cases first because there's an outcome that's going to affect someone. They may want to appeal us, or it's very important for us to give that decision because we're trying to remedy an ill in the economy. So these uncontested mergers, where the reasons, frankly, are not all that interesting, if you read our website and read those decisions, although we justify them, they're hardly surprising. The Commission has already made a recommendation, and our reasons tend to sort of be very similar to that. So that's why that statistic isn't that good. I just want to show you, though it's not good, the concern about that Commission is not that high either for that particular reason. If I can now go on to prohibited practices, I'm sorry, our language here is a bit. The Act is sometimes confusing as it calls talks about restrictive practice and prohibitive practices, except that they are the same thing. We're talking about cartel cases typically and abuse of dominance cases. And I wanted to make mention here in particular of three important cases here that were dealt with in the year, and they're important for different reasons. The first thing is the SBC case. This was a cartel case involving concrete pipe companies. Now, this case has unfortunately been overtaken by history since we did our annual report, because in our annual report is an important case on our decisions of how we approach fines of firms and how we approach high fines, because the one firm was high fined as much in percentage terms as we could. Well, unfortunately, the matter was taken on appeal. The appeal court has overturned us and also overturned the approach that we take to fines. So this was a very important precedent, but more recently it is no longer such, and we now have to see how we understand the appeal court decision and implement it in later cases. So the next case is the Pioneer case, which you may be well aware of. This was a settlement of a number of post-the-bread cartel cases involving wheat and flour with a Pioneer firm and the commission. And what was quite important here was this was done by a consent order, and it was a very innovative consent order, because there were remedies which, as it were, diluted the fine in favor of other payments. And the one payment was that there would be a payment to the Industrial Development Corporation to set up an agro-processing fund. And the second was that there would be a reduction in the fine, and in return the firm would discount its prices on flour for a certain period. And the idea of that second remedy was to start breaking up. In other words, there'd been a cartel, you wanted to break up the cartel behavior, and the idea of that remedy was to bring that into effect in practical terms by compelling one firm to be a much more aggressive supplier than its rivals, and seeing how that played out. And I think when you see the commission on Friday asking questions about this, because they've done follow-up research, and it appears that this remedy's worked quite well. I don't want to steal their thunder, because this has been this credit goes to the commission for their efforts, and that's done well. But that'll be an interesting thing that they can report to you on. It appears to have been successful. The other aspect, that part of the fine be reduced because it's diverted to a contribution to the RDC, is a matter that created some controversy and was in the newspapers. And what happened is that there was disagreement between the Commission and the Department of Finance and the Economic Development as to whether this remedy was permissible, because fines must be paid into the National Revenue Fund in terms of our act, and the concern about finance was that what should have been a fine was being diverted out of the National Revenue Fund into another institution. Now, there doesn't seem to be disagreement that this was a good outcome. There was disagreement as to the way this was being achieved, and at one stage it looked as if we were going to be faced with legal argument from the two departments as to whether this was permissible or not. Fortunately, I think the departments got together and they came up with a solution. The agreed solution, which you are probably aware of, is that the fine then was paid into the National Revenue Fund, but there was agreement between the Economic Development Department and Finance that the money would then be budgeted and given to the RDC, and that in fact took place in the budget. But I think it's raised an issue that members have previously asked about, and we've signaled, is that there is a concern by members of the public that fines go to the National Revenue Fund in a sense become anonymous in the sense and quite removed from either the industry concerned or the so-called victims. It was just kind of, here was an innovative attempt to try and deal with that problem, but you know, there are technical problems and governance problems around those kinds of solutions. But that was the next slide. This just deals with the total number of penalties that we've had per year in this year, and you'll see how much greater they are than the previous year. Previous year there were 292 million, this particular year 793 million. Now, I don't want to say, well, we worked much harder this year, we got more fines. It's just what cases get settled at a particular time, what is their nature that leads to that. So I'm reluctant to sound like the traffic department at a municipality who say we've brought in X amount, we're working very hard. That's not our approach to fines. I think we would rather go through a year where we gave no fines whatsoever because there was no anti-competitive activity. But there were a number of very large settlements in that particular year which led to that figure. If we go into the next slide, where we give you some breakdown as to where some of them were. The Pioneer Food Settlement that I mentioned to you was 500 million. That was the lion's share of that fine. There was also a big settlement between the Commission and Sasol Chemical Industries at 111.69. So you'll see that both of those fines come as a result of consent orders, not litigated proceedings. And the third one is Foscor. It's a much smaller fine, but it was a slightly unusual case. And there, initially, there was an excessive pricing case brought against Foscor by the Competition Commission, and they had agreed a remedy of excessive pricing, which did not include a fine. And my colleagues, I wasn't on that particular panel, but my colleagues who heard that said, if there's been excessive pricing for this length of time, there's got to be a better remedy than this one there. Go back and reconsider your consent order, which we're entitled to do. We can't compel people to agree, but we can refuse to give a consent order, or we can tell them to rethink it. And what happened is that the parties went back and rethought and came back to our panel and said, look, they would agree a remedy in which Foscor would pay a 6 million rand fine, and was then approved subject to that. If I can just draw your attention to the fact that in our annual report on page 88, this is shown as being a zero fine, a consent order with no fine. That is incorrect because I think initially it was going to be zero, and the consent order is not correct. It should be a fine of 6 million rand. So there's an error there which we just want to rectify. It's on page 88, and it's case number 43 CR of August 10.
Sorry, Commissioner, before you continue, are you aware of the other error? Is that on our presentation, there is no far force cover in 6 million?
Yes. The reason that is when we originally did the slides, we hadn't seen this error, so we just have actually rectified the slide now in the presentation.
Yeah.
And that's why your slide is different to
that. I don't remember that well, but not the same as
there is a change there.
Just
edit. Yeah. The reference in the annual report is page 88.
Page 88
of the annual report, because that is a schedule of all the consent orders. So apologies for that error. Our next slide is, again, I'm just getting back to in terms of practices, what we did with mergers is what's our efficiency, what's our performance, and this slide says that we what we do is we try to get matters heard within 20 days of close of pleadings, or we hold what is called a pre-hearing conference. We get the parties together and say, when can we set the matter down? And this shows that 4 out of 10 matters were heard within 20 days of close of pleadings. Why is that figure so low? Well, one of the reasons is that the parties are not ready for the litigation at the time we ask them to do so. And so we're looking at measures to try and improve that particular statistic, but it is like taking a horse to water. If they're not ready to go there, it's more difficult to do so. In other words, it requires both parties to the case to be ready to get the matter heard earlier. And I'll talk a bit later about innovations that we want to do about getting matters heard more earlier. And then the last statistic, 3 out of 4 matters were decided within 100 days of the last hearing. That's when I say decision there, that's writing the reasons. And the reason for that period is that you've got to not only give the order, but also write the reasons for that. more general comment. This is we like the Competition Commission participate in international bodies, and we continue to participate in meetings of the OECD and what is called the International Competition Network, and both our members and our staff attend these. The highlights of the year, just as a summary there, what I want to just point out here is the increase in the number of private practice cases. And I mentioned earlier, so we've gone from 10 cases to 30 cases. So that's very encouraging. Now, the credit for that actually goes to the Commission, not to ourselves. The Commission is the generator of our cases. If they don't bring any preemptive practice cases, we don't hear any. But what's encouraging is that statistic that I mentioned earlier, 73% of the cases are being settled by consent orders. And that's, as I mentioned earlier, we believe is a healthy outcome. Then other issues that we've done this year, we've revamped our website. So if I can just give an example, if you're following the Walmart case and if you're following it to date, you'll see all the major papers that are filed in the Walmart case are on a particular submenu on the website, and you can follow that. And the case has actually been followed internationally. And when we brought out our order in that case earlier this year, and we'd announced that it was actually going to come out at 2:00, the website froze. We couldn't actually get onto it. So many people were going onto the website that we couldn't get access to ourselves. So we had to get hold of the technical boffins and they had to turn off the website and turn it back on again. But it is showing that there is great following around the website, and what we've decided is that when we have cases in which there's a large public interest, we'll approach use the same approach and put the material on the website so that people can follow it, and then announce at what time we bring up the decision, so that everybody, wherever they are, is aware when the decision is coming out. They don't have to come to our offices in Pretoria and find out. The other issues that we've talked about are we've increased our internships. We have moved from taking just legal interns to taking people in our other departments, our finance departments and our administrative departments. We've also there's some procedural innovations that we've introduced this year, and I say so with a degree of trepidation, because the one procedural innovation is the subject of review in the Walmart matter. It's a matter, obviously, that's going to get a second look at it by the appeal court. But just to give you an indication of what it was, we are concerned, I think everybody else is to get matters heard more quickly and in less time than they might have heard. And I think that's a view that most people in the administration of justice would agree to. The solutions that one applies to that may differ. In the Walmart case, what we did was to restrict the number of witnesses who were going to be called, and to restrict the time period for cross-examination of witnesses, and applied in a way that was fair to all the parties who were before us, so that we could get the matter heard within an agreed period of time. And and as a result, that case ran within the 6 days that we set down for that particular case. And obviously, we'll see what the appeal court says about that procedure and whether they felt it was fair or unfair, but it is something that we would look at in later cases in order to get matters, particularly merger cases, where time is an absolute priority, heard more quickly. We're also trying to take charge of proceedings in a more aggressive way. In other words, we've previously been quite passive in allowing the parties to take as much time as they are doing to get matters heard. What we're trying to do is to start to take charge of matters right from the beginning, once we first have our first hearing, and to set a timetable that is more aggressive and demanding of parties than would otherwise be the case. And I was recently attended an Access to Justice conference hosted by the Chief Justice, the former Chief Justice, and it was interesting seeing that the courts themselves are wanting to do the same thing. So I think this is going to start, it's new to our legal culture, but hopefully will start becoming the norm. And people are saying judges have got to start taking charge of cases and getting them heard more quickly. And we want to sort of try and do this ourselves. Because we're a smaller institution, we can perhaps be more innovative, try things that other people won't necessarily be able to try than much larger institutions, to get cases heard more quickly and to be heard more efficiently and bring down the cost of litigation for everybody. And finally, just to we had a number of resignations amongst our case managers at the beginning of the year. We needed to fill up two positions, and we decided to put an extra person, so we managed to fill those positions quite quickly. So we have three new case managers, and that helps bring new energy into the organization always. Just to go into our next slide, I'll get to hand over to Narada just to take you through the next one.
In terms of the tribunal members, we haven't had any resignations or any new appointments this year, although we do have one vacancy available, and we trying to speak to the DG and the minister in order to fill that position. Tribunal staff, at the moment we have a staff complement of 15 in three divisions. Corporate services is headed by Genetic Lab, Research Division is headed by VT, and Registry Division is headed by myself. In terms of staff race and gender composition, we have 8 black females, 3 white females, 1 white male, 3 black males, and in total we have 4 males and 11 females. So organization is run by women. And in terms of tribunal members, we have 3 white males, 2 black males, 1 Indian female, 3 black females, and 1 white female. And they are very balanced. They have 5 males and 5 females. In terms of staff experience, we have 5 members of staff that have been with the tribunal for more than 10 years, and I think this is probably our 12th year now. And in that number, all the managers have actually been with the tribunal for more than 10 years. We have one staff member that has been with the tribunal for about 6 years now, and we have 9 staff members that have been with us for less than 5 years. And majority of the people in there are actually case managers who are in the research division. They're mainly people that have just graduated, and this would probably have been their first job. They leave the tribunal, and in a few years they actually do come back to the competition agencies again.
Thank you. I'll go on to give a brief summary of the financial affairs of the Competition Tribunal. And the first slide will show you that in terms of our budget, we underspent by about 19.95%, which is not unusual for the Tribunal, because it's very difficult for us to budget accurately, because so much of our budget is based on a guesstimate, in the sense of the number of hearing days that we're going to have during a year, because we've got no indication of how many matters will come before that us, and a lot of our budget is based on activities related to the hearing days. So in terms of the under expenditure, 18.33% of that under expenditure was on capital expenditure, and that is mainly due to the fact that we started later than we'd expected, and therefore the cost of it started later than we'd expected, and that was for the development of our electronic case document management system, which I think we've spoken to this committee about before. Then 11.33% was on training, and this wasn't because we didn't take people on training. It was more that we tried to make more of an effort to reduce costs around the costs associated with travel overseas, which is where most of our training takes place for the tribunal members and the researchers. And we did this by choosing to have more or less flexible tickets, which are often significantly cheaper than the more flexible tickets. And in addition, what we did is we hosted a tribunal members workshop in Pretoria in a local venue as opposed to a venue outside of Pretoria, which would have probably cost us more in terms of location and transport costs. Then 30.13% of that under expenditure was related to personnel expenses, and that was mainly due to the fact that we had budgeted a slightly higher increase for the tribunal members, and they didn't get a substantially high increase. And in addition, we had some vacancies while we were waiting to fill up the positions of vacant case managers. And the next slide is just really a summary of showing you the activity around the number of hearing days. And it just, in general, I think the thing to point out is that the number of hearing days between this financial year and the previous financial year increased, with the average number of hearing days that a tribunal member would have sat on was about 31.8 per tribunal member, as opposed to 20.46 in the previous year. And that will also, to some extent, affect our costs that are related to the hearings, like flights and transcription costs. In the next couple of slides, we talk mainly about financial performance. I think, again, we've had a high level of financial control within the tribunal. We've had spent a lot of time and effort in the previous financial year on updating all our financial policies and redrafting them and implementing new ones, both in terms of financial policies and accounting standards that we use in our financial statements. There are no balance sheet issues that I think need to be raised at this meeting, and all our finances are done on the accrual basis. And we've had a functioning audit committee, which meets on average four times a year. We were fortunate enough, again this year, to have an unqualified report with no financial misconduct and no significant findings. There were some findings, which I think are, to a certain extent, are common throughout many of the public entities and the departments, and one was non-compliance with supply chain management procedures, and that mainly pertained to the SPD-4s, which is a conflict of interest statement that suppliers are supposed to complete, and there was a lot of confusion around those, and we had one or two instances where we had not had a conflict of interest declaration from suppliers, and we have now made a substantial effort this year to get all of those in order. The new ruling is that you have to get them for every expenditure above 10,000, every single time you have a new supplier who's quoting for more than 10,000. Then we had some irregular expenditure, and the next slide shows you what it was, and it was related to ad hoc legal advice and to transcription services. And the issue there was more that we didn't have a deviation signed. With regards to the ad hoc legal advice, it was mainly pertaining to the use of one particular legal firm, both in terms of disciplinary issues in the employment environment, and the other was some ad hoc legal advice they gave us pertaining to a case. And the difficulty the tribunal has is that it's limited in who it can ask to give this legal advice, because many of these firms are appearing before us, and the issue wasn't that we shouldn't have spent the money, the issue was that we didn't sign a deviation, noting that that was the reason why we were only going to one particular firm. And then the transcription services is similar in the sense that one of the most important things with the hearings is that the transcription services are accurate and reliable, and that they can be referred back to if there's an issue with a hearing. And while we have a number of companies on our database, we tend to prefer one who historically has shown us that their service is good, that they provide accurate transcriptions, and that they time us and the equipment never fails. And again, it was just an issue where the Auditor General actually just wants us to note the deviation, which is a preference to use this particular company for the longer, more complicated hearings, and that we will continue to evaluate and use smaller companies throughout the year. So those are the two issues that were of concern in our audit report. The next slide just shows you a summary of our financial, first of all, the income side, with our total income was 21.81 million, with 62% of that being from government grants and the 32% from filing fees. Not sure whether the members will recall that one of the ways we get our money is that companies that are filing merger applications with the Commission have to pay a certain filing fee based on on the size of the merger, and we get a portion of that. So 32% of our income comes from that, and then roughly 6% is from other income, most of that being from interest that we will have earned on our surplus funds that sit with the CPD and some other small ad hoc income. On the expenditure side, this summary just shows you the percentage allocation across the broad areas of personnel, admin, training, professional services, part-time tribunal members' fees and other operating expenses. And the vast majority of our budget goes on personnel, and that would be the 18 people, 15 members of the secretariat and the 3 full-time members. You'll see there, for the first time this year, we are actually separating out the part-time tribunal members' fees, and that amounts to about 7% of our budget. Those part-time tribunal members receive a fee based on the number of days that they sit in a hearing, and then based on the number of preparation days that are allocated by the presiding chairperson for a particular case. And then I think really there's not significant changes across those line items, there's some minor changes. The next slide just shows the distribution of professional services fees. I think this is just because it's one area that often people want to know. And you'll see here that the biggest component here is our consulting fees, and it's not necessarily that we're paying outside consultants. That will include fees for risk management workshops and advice and assistance with our risk management framework. And it will also include the audit fees, and it will also include consulting around the various software programs we have in the office, like our accounting package and our payroll package. Public relations accounts for about 21%, and that's purely the services of a consultant to assist us with our public relations process and assist by briefing the media and providing press releases on certain cases. And then the recording fees is the transcription services, and facility fees is the fees that we pay both to the DTR for occupation on the campus, and then to the commission as part of the shared services. Because we're small, we can't necessarily procure services on our own, and we make use of some of the commission services, and that is a portion of the fee that we pay towards them. In terms of financial challenges going forward, I think it's always a question of continuous funding from the department. The tribunal has historically not needed to request increases in the funding allocations that's made to it, because we have these accumulated surpluses, which are historic accumulated surpluses, and not surpluses generated by underspending, but rather surpluses generated by increase in filing fees. And we're continuously making the EDD and Treasury aware of the fact that while we have these surpluses and they assist us in funding our budget over the next 3 to 4 years of the MTF period, at some point those surpluses are going to be drawn down significantly, and we will then have to ask the department for more funding. Then the other issue is that it tends to try and maintain low costs without compromising our work. It's difficult for us to create or to find cost efficiencies because our budget is so limited, and most of it is applied to salaries, but we try in as many ways as possible to reduce our costs. And the other big issue is aligning our budget to targets, because one of the new requirements of the framework, strategic framework, is that you try as much as possible to allocate your budget across your targets. And you'll see going forward, when the tribunal presents its strategic plan and annual performance plan, we have changed the number of targets, and we have changed the way in which we are now reporting on performance, and reduced them significantly and across 3 broad strategic outcomes. And what we're trying to do now is to allocate our budget as closely as possible to those outcomes. Then general challenges, I think Norman will address some of these, and then I'll talk to the rest of them. Okay, well, I'll talk to the three that I'm going to talk to are the Wyden intern program, the office space, and the implement of the case management system. Norman did talk earlier on about the internship program, where we have tried to increase it to include our administrative and registry sections, and we're going to continue to do that this year. We've tried during each of the school vacations to get in a university student to assist, or more than one university student to assist us. And the other initiative which we are quite excited about, and in a sense is an initiative that's arisen out of questions from this committee, is that we are about to enter into a relationship with DEFSA and offer a part-time employment 3 days a week to somebody that they have recommended to us, and hopefully we'll see that position may turn into a more permanent position. We're going to be starting that probably in the next couple of months, and I think it will be quite a change for the tribunal to get used to having to deal with someone who is hearing challenged, and we're hoping that also will assist us with a number of our administrative functions. In terms of office space, I think this committee is aware of the fact that the space on the campus has been an issue for us, and while it is not as significant for the tribunal as it is for the commission, we are increasingly finding that our space is becoming smaller and smaller. And we will continue together with the Commission to try and find ways of getting more space, whether it's on the campus or off the campus. That does, of course, imply some cost implications, and while we didn't specifically put it in our funding request, we did draw EDD and Treasury's attention to the fact that if we are required to move off the campus, it will require some additional costs on our part. The other big challenge coming forward for us is the implementing of the case management system. We are almost near the end of the development phase and about to begin the testing phase of the electronic case document management system, which I think has got a number of reasons behind it. One is that it's going to enable us to manage all the case documents electronically, and the other is that it's going to assist significantly in getting out some of the performance information that we require, because it's going to be built into the system and can be generated almost at the press of a button. It is going to mean changes in the work environment, because people are going to have to get used to different ways of working and using the new technology. So that's going to be a challenge for us, but it's also a very big excitement to see what we can get out of it, because I think we've worked long and hard on getting a system that should produce the kinds of results that we're seeing and should produce the kinds of reports that will enable us to report more effectively on what we're doing in the tribunal and how fast we're doing it and the costs associated with some of those processes. So I think those are the three main challenges, and then Norman will address the others.
Perhaps I'll just work backwards through the remaining issues. I think I've mentioned the expedition of the case resolution issues before, and say that's an ongoing challenge for us to implement both in mergers and practice cases. The improving access to justice there is that last year we reported that we had set up a relationship with an NGO known as Pro Bono, and what we wanted Pro Bono works by referring cases to law firms who are its partners, who agree to provide legal advice to deserving people free of charge. And what we asked them to do was to reconsider their business model, because they at the moment were acting for people who would otherwise qualify for legal aid through a means test, and say, look, it's not really analogous to the competition environment where in a sense the people who need access to advice are not indigent, they're actually in business, but they simply cannot afford the legal advice that take on a large firm who may be abusing its dominance. So we asked them to rethink that particular way of working and to establish that relationship with law firms. We had a meeting last year with law firms, and there was a lot of interest from law firms and economic consultancy firms in doing this. Then they had a discussion with the Law Society, and the Law Society was a little more reluctant about allowing this pro bono work to qualify for the Law Society's pro bono allocation, because they were concerned that if these firms could afford legal advice, they would take away business from law firms. So the actual final outcome has been less has been less, covers less people than we would have liked in our particular instance, but nevertheless exists. But the Law Committee of the Competition Law Subcommittee of the Law Society has agreed to prevail upon its members to still do so, to take some of these referrals themselves, even if they don't qualify for their pro bono hours. And so what we've set up now is that on our website, if it says, do you need a lawyer to give you advice, you can phone pro bono, and pro bono will then contact lawyers, and people at least be advised, given free advice in the first consultation, and it's up to them, the law firm, as to whether the law firm will take the matter on afterwards. So it's, at least we've got the program set up. It's early days yet. We'll see how far-reaching it is. We know of at least one case where in a seed merger, which we had before us recently, one of the parties, which is a non-governmental organization, was represented by a law firm and by counsel as a result of this particular scheme, and they were able to at least get their viewpoint across to the tribunal. Further training on tribunal members, related to our case turnaround, is that we want more tribunal members writing. At the moment, most of the writing is done by the three full-time members. That's suboptimal. We want more members writing, which means that we must train members more. So what we've started in this year is we've sent two members on a training course to the UK for specialised training. And we've also had, we ran on Tuesday of this week, a writing workshop in judicial writing, which was run by a retired judge for us. So we're trying to get more members, particularly our part-time members, writing decisions, which hopefully will also speed up our processes. Finally, as we mentioned earlier, the need to appoint additional tribunal members. We're in the process of interacting with the department about these appointments. The appointments can't be made by ourselves. The appointments are made by the President acting on the advice of the Minister of Economic Development. But we've indicated that we would like more members appointed, and we hopefully will have a resolution soon, because that too will assist us in both hearing cases more frequently and having additional skills for us to deal with. So that's essentially our input then. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you to the Competition Tribunal. I would like to hand over to the chairperson so that she can be able to give us the way forward after this. I believe she indicated that she was asked to take a break, but I will hand over to her and then to announce that, and from there you will outline what to follow. Thanks. Okay. Thank you very much. I think it would be better we just go break for a few minutes. I think 5 to 10. That will be enough. Then we'll engage thereafter. The tea is getting cold out.
I think the whip has already thanked you for the presentation. I thought you have one or two things to continue before we go to the question. Thank you.
Chair, just two issues which are subsequent to the annual report, but I think are current themes affecting the competition authorities, and I just thought that they should be mentioned. One is that, as you will hear, I think, from the Competition Commission on Friday, they have been beset by a number of procedural challenges to their prosecutions, and they've been on the receiving end of some adverse decisions from the Competition Appeal Court and the Supreme Court of Appeal of quite a technical nature, but the practical implication is that the number of the Commission's prosecutions have been stillborn, and they haven't actually got to the merits. And the Commission is very concerned about this, as are we. And one of the initiatives that the Commission has embarked upon is to take these matters to the Constitutional Court. They've identified a number of cases which they think best exemplify this approach, and they're taking them, as it were, the group to the Constitutional Court, which hopefully will be heard sometime soon, to try and get a kind of legal principle which is more about access to justice rather than these cases which say fairness to the the accused firm. It has meant that a number of significant cases the Commission has brought have failed, and we've, in a sense, because we're bound by the precedent of the higher courts, have had to implement those decisions. And the most recent example was a case we decided, again, it's outside the reporting period, but it involved a case against certain breweries, which we had to dismiss on these grounds before the case was concluded. So the case had been running for some time. As a result of a recent Competition Appeal Court decision, SA Breweries decided to take this technical point. We felt we were bound by the precedent and upheld the objection. The case was dismissed. The Commission is, I think, going to appeal that decision, amongst others. But it is having an effect on the system, and it will depend on the outcome in the Constitutional Court. But if there's possibly an unfavourable outcome to the decision, the Commission may well, as we're coming back to this committee at some time, for possible suggestions of some law reform. At the moment, I think they're trying to see, can we make the system as it exists under the current law work better? So that's one issue I want to bring to your attention. The other is the existing Amendment Act to the Competition Amendment Act, which was done in 2009 by your colleagues there at the Trade and Industry Committee, as it was the committee responsible for this piece of legislation. And the amendment involved a number of issues, including criminalisation of cartels. And the amendment has been signed by the President, but has not been proclaimed, and so it's not yet in force until it's proclaimed by the President. And there appear to be a number of reasons around, concerns around the practicality of the criminalisation that has delayed this amendment. But one of the questions I would raise for the committee to consider, with perhaps with the Ministry and perhaps raise with my colleagues at the Commission, is whether the also within that amendment are a number of other issues, one of which is the provision for a market inquiry. Now, the market inquiry is a sort of less adversarial way of looking into problems in the market and coming up with a solution. And if you noted my previous slide, that 73% of the matters are resolved by consent, it appears that we're more effective by bringing people together in the room and saying, look, let's let the market sort itself out here. And so the market inquiry could be a very useful mechanism for dealing particularly with abuse of dominance problems in the economy without people feeling they're facing a prosecution and a fine. So it would be useful if the criminal matters are requiring other considerations that are delaying them. It might be useful if consideration was given to bring the market inquiry provisions into force quite soon, and separately from the other provisions in the Act, because they would provide an extra armory to the Commission in a useful way, and hopefully speed up some solutions into concentration.
Thank you very much, Emmanuel. I think that was very important that you talked to. And if colleagues remember, I think our last interaction with the Commission, Mr. Ambrose did refer to this issue. And perhaps it will be important that in our next interaction with the Minister, we just get an update on where the matter is. Okay, may we then interact with the presentation as presented earlier on? Dr. Rabi, Method Desi, Temare, then Julie.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you very much, Mr. Madrid. Thank you so much for your submission. In your concluding paragraph, you mentioned that you think that you need additional tribunal members. Now, our economy, how many additional members do you think will be needed if you really want to sort of speed up your turnaround time? And have you started and to start taking any sort of what is called proactive measures to sort of accommodate the additional members. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I can say, is it funded as you or you you've got so many forced, or it depends on the president, whether, how does it work? Lastly, is the bursaries. Do you have any bursaries before for the children in your institution? Thank you, Charles.
Thanks, can I start with the space, especially on issues to Ms. Clerk? And space issues. How serious is the space issue affecting the tribunal? And are you looking at expanding the tribunal, either than, I mean, staff-wise, either, or is it only space in relation to hearings? I heard that more members are needed for the tribunal, but I'm more interested in the space, because the DG spoke about the space issue getting resolved with the DTI, but I don't know how far does it. Last time you did tell us, you did show us actually when we visited you, you know, the rooms where you were conducting your hearings and so forth. But I just want to understand as to whether is it as serious as it affects the department, as serious as it affects the commission and others, or have you discussed that matter before with the DG, or in terms of your of the fact that you are independent from the department, why didn't you take that decision before of moving on your own? Are there any things that, for instance, are causing you to remain within the campus itself? I want to understand further the pro bono issue, Mr. Manoy. Because I'm not sure whether how it functions. You tried to explain, maybe as it was mentioned before, one didn't have a similar understanding, but I just want to clarify, because you're saying you checked whether other law firms don't have a problem, for instance, in terms of restricting them of not getting, you know, access. I just want to check whether have you cleared such things now, who is pro bono per se, and how transparent are pro bono, you know, activities to the whole legal fraternity, so that we don't find that later on there are cases, you know, that would or complaints around how issues of access are restricted. Is coming to other issues, I think administrative issues again. You said Kanake. Lerato, you said is it you or is it Ms. Declare, but in, between the two of you, you have of course people who are leaving and coming back into the institution. What would be the cause of those people? What would be attributable to those people leaving the tribunal and coming back later on and being accepted? Last time we had, I think it was from Mr. Ramboro, that there is this recycling of recycling of legal competition lawyers within. I just want to know, is it because of scarcity issues? Is it because people are taking advantage of the system? What are the issues? What are the issues related to that? And if there's any regulation in terms of, you know, people doing that kind of, because we've seen in other professions where people, because of the scarcity issue, scarcity of skills, people would then, you know, jump from one department to the other, knowing that they will be accepted. They go to another department, you know, undermine leadership, get released, and then go to another one, and then come back again. We've seen that. I just want to know the reasons for this one. On irregular matters, irregular expenditure matters, I had Mr. Clerk trying to explain, but irregular is irregular. And I think, according to the explanation from the Auditor General, in terms of irregular, a definition of irregular expenditure, is that it is the expenditure incurred in contravention of or not in accordance with the requirement of any applicable legislation, including the PFMA. So the expenditure portion of any regular expenditure is charged against surplus in the period. But what is important is just the definition. And if, for instance, you have irregular expenditure, I had you explain it. But while I understand issues, the explanation, but I think it's also important that you also understand the serious nature. You know, the first institution that we're dealing with on this matter. And my sense is that, you know, it's just taken as a by the way. It's not taken as serious as it has to be serious. Because unless proven otherwise, I don't think the Auditor General can just put something under irregular expenditure for the sake of doing that. You had an under expenditure of 30.13% due to the lower increases to full-time members. Was this a deliberate thing, or was it influenced by something? I don't think in the report to be getting that explanation. The training under expenditure, I do understand that you decided to do training in South Africa instead of abroad. I just want to find out as to where abroad were you normally doing the training? Or is it scattered everywhere? And this training is for who? Is it for the personnel or is it for the members? And 11.33%, why is it an underspending? Because, you know, in other institutions, they would term it a saving, which is normally a surplus. You term it, of which I think it qualifies to be a saving, because this is money saved from, you know, a particular activity. But you're calling it under expenditure. Why would you term it under expenditure instead of saving? Because your explanation your capital under expenditure, is it going to be, are you going to apply for rollover, or have you already been, applied for rollover for, is it now or still coming? These are the questions that I wanted to ask. Other comments, I think I already had comments, and let me just join my colleagues in appreciating the fact that you've been conducting yourself so good in such a way that you keep your books clean and traceable, means you have good record keeping mechanism or procedures within the institution itself, and that calls for, that's very commendable, if I may say, because and I don't think you've been disappointing thus far. You are doing well. We will come back to the next set of questions wherein I think we'll also venture more into the work that you are doing vis-a-vis of the Competition Commission. May I hand over to Mr. Manning for response?
Thanks very much for those comments. If I can just deal with perhaps deal with matters that I can deal with, and then deal with some of the matters that my two colleagues can deal with, they can take thereafter. You asked regarding the appointment of additional members. Can I just distinguish between our members, who are the people who hear the cases, and our staff? Members are, the appointment of members is laid down in the Competition Act, and we are, there is a maximum provided for, unfortunately, that's what's in the Act. And the Act says that that our maximum membership can be 11, the chair and 10 other members. At the moment, we have 10 people in office, so we only have a vacancy for one further person. And the idea is that we appoint another member who would be a part-time member. So the budgetary issues are not huge in terms of the fact that part-time members are only paid when they actually sit in the case. So the budgetary issues aren't huge. But the responsibility for appointing the members lies with the president, advised by the line Department of Economic Development. We have approached the department and are waiting for a meeting to see them about that. It may also be that we are able to, and depends on how quickly the department can see itself responding to this. Some of our members have indicated to us that they are not in a position to be as active as they were previously when they were appointed members, served for a 5-year term. And at least one member said to me, look, I will hang in for the time being, but if more members can be appointed, I'm willing to resign. You can replace me by somebody who can be more active. So in that respect, yes, we can appoint at least one other member, but there may be that there are one or two people who are less active than they are at the moment, who would be willing to, as it were, resign, and we could fill the space. That's the kind of conversation I'd like to have with the line department to do so. But we are not responsible ourselves for appointing the members. It's done by the president on the advice of the minister, and it's finally their decision. As far as ordinary staff members are concerned, we can appoint our members as and when we see a need. At the moment, our staff complement is adequate, because only the members can actually sit on the panel and decide cases. Then we were asked about the increase in penalties and whether we're seeing recidivism. In other words, are we seeing people who have been fined the second time round? And if so, what can we do about it? Let me answer the second part first. The Act says that if you've previously been fined under the Act and you come up again for a similar offence, then the fine can be increased, so we can remedy that. Has that occurred yet? And the answer is no. But I qualify that a bit by saying, although we haven't had to fine the same firm twice for a similar offence, certain firms have committed offences of a similar nature around the same time, and the examples par excellence have been the bread making companies who were involved in allegedly cartels around bread. Well, I shouldn't say allegedly, it's now been established around some of them around wheat and some around other ingredients at the same time. So in other words, they've been involved in cartels with different people in different markets for different products. Is there recidivism? At the moment, we can't say definitively. It appears that these matters occurred more or less around the same time and that they were uncovered at the same time. It's just that some took longer to uncover than the others, or the commission is taking longer to prosecute. So I don't think that, speaking from the tribunal side, that we can say definitively a firm that was fined and convicted has committed the offence again. It appears that where firms have committed more than one offence, they did so more or less at the same time, they were uncovered at the same time. So we can't say definitively at this stage that people, having been fined, then went out and committed offences again. What has happened is that the same firms have committed various different offences in different markets, and they've kind of been discovered more or less at the same time because they've had leniency programs. So that's as far as I can really take it from our experience point of view. Then, if I can go to the issue of interns, we can provide you with breakdowns on gender and race. I don't have those at hand, but we can probably get them over. My colleagues can give them there. But if I could just mention one, our policy is to try and work with institutions who can identify them. One that has the benefit of them screening people and we find the right people. So we at the moment we have a relationship with the University of Pretoria, which has identified legal graduates for a number of years, and the other relationship has been with a non-governmental organisation called the Alexander Education Committee in Johannesburg, which provides bursaries to students from school to university, and again they can screen people for us and say, look, here's a person, can you give them an internship in your accounts department? So we're looking forward to actually developing relationships with people who can do the screening for us and find new people for us as years go by, and we find that valuable. The other thing useful about interns is it's good to actually offer interns, instead of having, typically law interns will come during their holidays and spend a couple of weeks with you. And we're finding it useful to actually have people who've worked out well and offer them to come back in their next holiday, because we can offer them more challenging work the second time round. So if we can establish a relationship with somebody, we'll give them another opportunity. It means they can do more challenging work. And one of the benefits of working in an institution like us is it gets you, connects you to networks which might find you a job. So the more somebody is exposed to us, the more they are likely to connect with the networks. The next issue was an issue on around mergers. Is do we only deal with mergers when there's a change in majority of control and shareholding? The answer is that the definition of merger in the Act is quite a wide one, and it says a merger is something when there is a change in control over a business. And although the change in majority shareholding is the most common one, we're not confined to that. And in theory, even a minority shareholding which gives you de facto control would be a merger, and that arises from time to time, just as the sale of business assets leads to a change in control over that business. So our definition is much wider than 51%, and it's useful for that purpose. Sometimes there's a grey zone as to whether there is a change of control or not, but those cases are few, but we're wider than 51%, and we recognise that control can be achieved below 51%. So the Act is actually very good in that respect. Although we talk of mergers, it is an acquisition in a sense. We use the terms conservatively to be the same thing. Then we asked about the relationship between public interest and anti-competitive effect. The only time that we are concerned in the Act with the public interest is in merger adjudication. And what the Act provides is that the merger can be anti-competitive, but it could be saved because it's good for the public interest. Conversely, you could say the merger may create no competition problems, but may create competition concerns. And so Walmart was an example of a merger which I think everybody agreed didn't create a competition concern, but people differed in their views to whether it created a public interest concern. And so the Competition Act allows an intervention around both, and that could lead to different results, in which case you have to weigh up both of them. The relationship is quite a complicated one, and it's come up. The most active area in which the public interest has been looked at under merger of the Act has been in employment. The public interest is, under the Act, limited to a fixed number of issues. In other words, it's not a general public interest that there is under some other legislation. It's got to be a public interest that has an effect on employment, effect on the industry, effect on small or black-owned businesses, and the ability of South African firms to become internationally competitive. So if you have a public interest concern, it's got to come under one of those four categories. Now, the Walmart case would be the first time that the appeal court would have to deal with what is the public interest and our particular view on the public interest as to whether that is correct or not. They haven't previously dealt with that. So when I mentioned the appeal court and having overturned this in a number of cases, those have not dealt with the public interest. There have been cases that the one case involved the principals approaching fining in a cartel case, and the other cases involved interim relief cases, and it was a view as to whether there was sufficient evidence to grant interim relief or not. So the court has yet to pronounce on the relationship with the public interest and merger concerns. Leave the issue of under expenditure to Janine. Then there was an issue relating to bursaries for students, I'm not sure whether I've understood that. Is that do we give our staff bursaries to study, or do we provide other students the ability to do? We don't provide bursaries to students who don't work for us. We simply don't have the budget to do so. So what we can provide students is internships, but we don't have the budget to provide internships. But we do provide bursaries to our own staff to study, and that's taken up quite actively and works quite well.
It depends. We have a policy in place where they're not. The current policy is that the bursary is for a maximum of 8,000 rand at any point in time. We find that most of our students study in semesters, so they will apply for their subjects, and it's generally somewhere between 2 to 4 subjects, depending on what course they're doing. They then write those exams, and if they pass, then it's converted into a bursary, and then they will then reapply again for the next period. So at the moment, it's about a maximum of 8,000 rand, and I think we probably have about 3 or 4 students who make use of it. I think most of the people who are employed in the tribunal already have at least, some of them have a minimum university degree, and others are studying towards their master's, whereas some of the other staff, the administrative staff, are trying to do a part-time study through UNISA or through some other institution, and then they just apply on an annual basis or sometimes twice a year once they've passed, and then reapply again. Yes, if they don't pass, and it doesn't get converted into a bursary, and they have to repay that amount of money, and that's basically what the condition is. So when they make an application, we generally make a decision as to whether it's are they studying towards their own degree, or is it something that we should be offering them as part of training on the job. If sometimes we see it's training on the job, then we will take that up as an expense, and they will then undergo the training. But if it's generally towards getting a UNISA degree or through some technical college, then we assist them, and they, as and when they pass, it just gets converted to a bursary, and then or to a loan if they don't pass.
And as far as you do further as attention
I don't really think so. because a fair proportion, if you look at the case managers, invariably all of them already have a basic degree and they might be doing their LLB or a master's in law. And then within corporate services, there are some people who are studying, and you know they will apply as and when. But we don't have a high turnover of staff. The turnover occurs in the case managers or the research section, and I think that is just because there's much more opportunity for them outside of the tribunal than there is, because we're small and we've got a very low hierarchy. There's not much place for people to move up within the organisation. So they come there, they get experience, and then they often are taken on by other law firms and sometimes by the commission once people see that they are good and worth taking on. So that's where our turnover happens, not so much in the administrative and registry staff.
So where would you say the
Currently, I think there are about five of us, I think, have been there more than 10 years, and three of them are in the registry. One happens to be Lerato, and then two of her staff, and then the other one is myself, and the other one is Rizzi, who's the head of research or case management. One of the other staff members who has been there now, she's going into her sixth year. She's in corporate services. She's one of my staff members. And then the others have been there probably, in my department, have been there ranging from 1 to 4 years. And then the researchers, I think three of them are new. They started in March of this year. And two of them have been there probably 3 years, I think, for Liwe and Ephelim.
So you don't worry about the issues of experience and all the deployment for that matter?
I think it does matter, but you know, in the sense that one does need some experienced people, but it's also an opportunity to provide people with training and experience in the competition environment. And I think we're aware of the fact that often the people that come into the research department are not necessarily going to stay there a long time. So we've always managed to have a situation there where you've got a balance between experienced and new people. So often what happens is the new people come in and they become more experienced and they get into maybe stay there 3 to 4 years and then they leave and then the next lot move up and the new ones start. So we kind of tend to be recycling outside of us a lot of the research staff.
So it doesn't affect the quality of your research?
Sometimes it does, but I think I think the analogy would be article clerks in a law firm or an accounting firm. It's where you enter the profession. So a good person in that position is not going to be there for a very long time, because as they get more skilled, they will you know, other opportunities will be available for them. Conversely, somebody who's not that great may be with you longer than you'd like them to be. So it does affect us in the sense that you have to keep reskilling people, as do law firms when they have new article clocks coming along. But on the other hand, you do want bright young people who are going to be ambitious and take things further. And so that means that they will, after 2 or 3 years, leave us. And we are prepared for that, and we designed our training systems around that. And we accept that as a reality. We'd rather have a good person for a short time than a bad person for a long time, but quite simply. We all have also found, and perhaps that relates to your earlier question, what Lerato was referring to, that people have sometimes left us to join the commission in a more senior position. And that's been seen as quite a good thing by both us and the commission, because someone has done well, they've gone through our system, and they're now ready to go up the next rung. And the commission, which is a bigger organization, and has a greater hierarchy of positions, can offer those people an opportunity, but they stay in public service. So we've had a number of people who've been our case managers who are now with the commission in a more senior position, and both institutions see this as a good thing. And similarly, they've had people who've come as interns in the commission. They have a one-year internship, and they're looking for a job, and we've looked at them as future case managers. So there's been a kind of synergy between these two institutions. So we see that as a positive thing rather than as a negative thing that people have moved, because they've been moving up a ladder skill-wise as young professionals. It's been a good thing. The commission more than us loses people to private practice because they are offered further opportunities in private practice, but they're in a better position to speak to that experience than we are. We occasionally lose people to private practice because they're case managers, they get an opportunity to get a more senior position, and the pay is better in private practice.
I'm just worried about really experience, having more experienced people, because they shift like that. It means we don't have an opportunity to create that, you know, a good skill. Like you're saying, sometimes it's good to have a good person for a shorter period. But I would argue that I would better develop that person into more quality person. So that person can also be in a position to understudy you and perhaps be able to take over as time goes on. Unlike, you know, people coming in and going, without proper experience and real feel of what the whole institution is all about. To me, that is very important, because I was told that the competition lawyers, especially in the previous disadvantage, are very few. As a result, you have societies that have been formed, and those societies are dominated by the previously advantaged people. And for me, I would like to see that being changed, being turned around. And I feel this type of practice, that's all I'm asking, if you can use Bezalis as a way of retaining them, because that would mean staying longer, getting more exposure, more experience in the work that they're doing, so that by the time they move on, at least they understand what the whole system is all about. We need to develop. This is about developing the skill within the country. So, and unfortunately, I can't talk without referring to transformatory issues. We have to transform, and that is the area where of my concern. Yes.
I think, if I should respond to that, the opportunity for young black lawyers to get into this area has actually come through the commission and the tribunal. So even though people may ultimately end up in the private sector, I mean, we start a big case next week, and there is a young one of the big corporate teams is a young black advocate. He was formerly employed by the Competition Commission as a legal counsel. He was able to, as it were, break through that glass ceiling because he'd been employed by the commission, got a good reputation, went into private practice. He probably wouldn't have this is no reflection of his ability, but he probably wouldn't have got that opportunity had he not initially started with the commission. So I think even though we may be losing lawyers to private practice, it is transforming private practice, and there is a good turning out of that.
That's fine. But I had the same with Mr. Ramborod when he presented that. He complained that he's losing a lot of people, and because they can't retain, because these people, because they're scared, and therefore they look for greener pastures, and because they know that this industry is very it's serviced by scarce resource, therefore they move around. And to me, it's not about being able to move around and getting opportunities, higher opportunities. It's about getting enough experience so that as you go out there, you are a quality instead of a quantity. You're not just counted among the numbers. It's the type of caliber that you are that everybody would feel proud of at the end of the day. That's my argument. Okay, you may continue. You want to come in on the follow up?
Yes.
Ask
the question about the breakdown of race and gender for the four interns.
going to be one of my responses. In the last financial year, when we had four students, three of them were black and one of them was a white student. Two of those students came through the University of Pretoria's initiative that Norman spoke about with the law department, and then one came through the Alexandra Education Institute, and the other was a student who approached us and was needing vacation employment. Now, I think we need to say also that these four interns, only one of them was paid, and that was the one who came by the Alexandra Education Unit. The two that came from the University of Pretoria as part of their work experience, part of their degree, so they come and are suggested to us by the university, and the other student just wanted some experience during holidays in the tribunal, and she worked mainly in Lerato's department. And then I think the big area where, you know, we're small, so we can't offer long internships. We tend to only be able to offer it during the vacations and for specifically earmarked work that we can identify in our departments. But one of the ways that we're going to try to be dealing with this is also with DEFSA and get in a student there three times a week, and then also hopefully provide this person with some additional skills by enabling them to use some of our financial systems and train them so that at some point they'd be able to move on to another institution with some experience. And it's the same with the student we got from Alexander Education Center. He came back again in the July holidays and worked with us. His report's in our annual report. And one of his comments was that he would like to have more challenging work, so we gave him more challenging work. And they do perform a role of assisting us, but at the same time, we spend a lot of time training them and helping them learn new skills within the tribunal. So we'll continue to do that, but in terms of the numbers, we're limited, especially given that we only do have a staff of 15 ourselves. Then there was a number of issues around the underspending or saving. I think...
Sorry, just before you get that, there was really a question around pro bono, so perhaps let me deal with that before you can deal with financial. But just on the issue of pro bono, the Law Society, which regulates the attorney's profession, requires attorneys to spend a certain amount of time on doing free work, what lawyers call pro bono work. And so firms have an incentive to do that sort of work. An NGO was then set up called Pro Bono to meet that need. And they are a mixture of people who've been in the legal world or been involved in justice NGOs. And they identified a need in the market to link members of the public with law firms willing to do that work to get their pro bono hours. And so they really act as a referral agency. A member of the public will come to them and say, look, I've got a family problem, can you help me? And then they will find a firm that does that kind of work and link the client with them, and they do that work for free. So what we have tried to do with pro bono was to apply it to the competition law model and say, look, there are a number of firms out there who specialize in competition law. They make quite a lot of money doing this work from big corporations. They can do a bit of work for the public. The difficulty that came about is that the Law Society is not yet willing to recognize that work for pro bono work unless the client base is indigent people or NGOs. The type of client base that we expect in these things are small businesses who are neither indigent nor NGOs. But some law firms who belong to our law committee have been willing to take these referrals and give advice, even though it doesn't qualify for pro bono work and they get recognition of those hours. The difficulty is that they may be willing to give one sort of advice to somebody about whether they think they've got a good case or a bad case. And quite a lot of these people often just simply need to be told, this isn't really a good competition law case, it's a good consumer case or something else. But if it comes to litigation where they've got to represent people, then it's quite a burden on that law firm in terms of doing free work, and remains to be seen if law firms are willing to go that further mile and do that kind of work for free on somebody else's behalf. There's nothing in law stopping them from doing that. There's certainly nothing in our proceedings. It's just the willingness of the particular law firm to take that case on, and that remains to be seen.
The questions are...
Yes, the response goes back to what you have alluded to in terms of the certification. I think in my previous engagement, were not happy about the fact that the two interns were not South Africans, because a lot of times people will put their country first. As they qualify and become highly competent, they may go back to our countries. So I don't think we have to shy away from fair discrimination, pretending South African. And I think in that way, one or the other, not 100%, but it will have some positive results where people will remain in the company.
Historically, your recollection is correct. The first two people we got through our Pretoria University program, one was from Nigeria and one was from Botswana. The person who was most recently there has been a South African. The people on the other programs have been South Africans.
So the situation has changed. Because last time you said, you reported that mainly people, I don't know whether it's you or it's the competition commission, mainly people are from outside South Africa who are willing to be intent in the or recruited into tribunal, if I remember well. That
I don't think it was that. Ours really, it really has been dependent on the university has been finding the right person for us. So some years they've been. I think it would depend very much on what's going on in the university's faculty and department that year of people who were available. So there's certainly no policy from our point of view around that.
And so, but the people who are getting are South African.
Certainly, in the past year, all the people we've had in terms of being South African.
Okay, and then that's from the University of Pretoria, from Alexandra. What is
The Alexandra Education Committee, the South African. That's Alexandra outside Johannesburg. And this is an educational NGO which has bursary money. And so what they've done is to identify and say, look, here's a promising person who would be funded during school. Person is now doing a BCom. Could you put them with your accountancy department for a month or so? That's how it works.
I think that Kedra, as being of the university being the one who is student for you, the intent, we were also not happy because as they go through training or the intent, it is at the extent, not at the extent. I think my view of the criteria that this is not the one.
Sorry, it's not at our expenses. The University of Pretoria people are not paid. And they do work for us for nothing, so in a sense we benefit for nothing from what they've done. But what the university does is it allocates students to a number of institutions of which we are one, and it very much depends on what their requirements are that particular year. It's not that they're always going to send us a foreign student, but we certainly aren't paying for it all. If anything, we are getting something out of those people. They're doing work for us, which we are not having to pay.
Is it because of your proximity to UP, or is it by the other factors? Because I would imagine a learner from VET, UJ, UCT, would also, or anywhere, other institutions of higher learning would want to also have such intention.
It's partly due to proximity, but it's the leadership of a faculty which is willing to actually do this. That's really what we've actually spoken to this a number of times and said, look, we'd be happy to get people if they're available. But Pretoria is the one that has actually gone out there and implemented it. So it's reflections on the institution. It's obviously convenient for the students and us because we're in Sunnyside, Pretoria, and they are nearest educational institution to us, which is law faculty, which also does competition law.
Sorry, can I also just add, the students that come from the University of Pretoria are coming as part of an elective course of the final LLB students, and one student that was there now in this current vacation period said to me, what happens is that they have various institutions that offer positions on the campus, and then students will see so-and-so so-and-so is offering a position and so-and-so is offering a position, and then they go to the department and they say, I'm interested in working in the competition tribunal, or I'm interested in working in this particular one, and then they channel the request through to us. So it's depending on what students come forward and say, I'm interested in working in the competition tribunal, then they'll channel them through, because presumably some of those students want other experiences. So they come via whatever ads are placed on the University of Pretoria.
So how many people would you handle per year as intern, for instance? Because if you're saying it's only people from, let's say there are others who are interested, would you be willing, for instance?
We would consider them, but I don't think that we, you know, size-wise, we can't take on a lot of people, because it means then that a lot of your time is spent with that particular person, especially in corporate services or in registry, you know, showing them things. And in research, it's a bit different, because they can be given specific tasks that may take longer and engage them more, whereas ours, we have to find various small things for them and, you know, teach them processes and teach them accounting packages. So I think we've had, in the December holiday, I think we had three at one time. One of them was the University of Pretoria student, and the other two were students who were working in corporate services. One who had come through the Alexander Education Unit, and that was his second holiday with us, and the other was a student who had come through University of Pretoria who was doing something with economics and business administration and wanted that experience. So I would say most times in my department, I can probably take two in a holiday and give them work to do. But it does impact on our own work, so it's important that they don't come too much near financial year end when we've got a lot of work that we have to do. So December was ideal for us, because it was the time when there's not a lot going on in the office, and it enabled you to teach them and show them how the systems work and involve them in a number of processes, and they could sit in audit committee meetings and risk management workshops. And then in July, we earmarked more specific tasks for them to learn and new experiences. I think it does help if we can have, in my department, certainly have the same student coming back again, because he understands it, and it's one way of developing him and giving him work experience that will help him later when he's finished. And he comes from the University of Johannesburg, and he travels in every day.
When I talk about the expense as a tribunal, not only hard cash to be expense, but the resources, I mean, for them to get exposure, they benefit from you as well.
Okay. I just wanted also to bring to your attention that you are a national institution, and therefore anybody within the country should have an opportunity to access you. And I'm worried about your proximity issues and collaboration with the University of Pretoria. On the other hand, the concern was around not having sufficient competition lawyers. I understand it's on administration issues mostly, but also we want people to be understanding or learning more about competition law, maybe to gain interest, because youngsters don't know anything about it. When you talk law, it's law, and they don't know where is the need, unless maybe we publicize, you know, the work that we're doing in such a way that it would attract more interest from their side. So that's the reason why we're raising this issue. So that, because last time we did raise it, and we got promised that no, this is something that can be available to everybody. The problem of many people being there, I agree, but if that's a problem, you could perhaps rotate annually. Maybe you attend to the Pretoria, maybe you attend to others in the coming year. But introduce yourself to those universities. Collaborate with them so that they are able then to send their people. Maybe they are not aware that you're having such a program, intern program within the institution. We can also assist where possible so that that you are able then to get more people interested in your institution. I think that's something that we need, we will be following up also on. Thank you. You may continue.
Kevin, the financial questions that were raised, the one was around the underspending. I think, as I said earlier, the problem with the tribunal's budget is that it's very difficult to predict exactly how many hearings we think we're going to have and how many number of days we're going to spend, we think we're going to spend in hearings. And a lot of our budget is driven by that, in the sense that that determines the number of, you know, the fees we have to pay the part-time members who attend. It determines the cost of getting them to a meeting, and it determines the amount of time that's spent in hearings and the amount of time that we need to engage with transcription services to take them. So our budget is drawn on an estimate of the number of hearings. And then sometimes we are close to that, other times we aren't. So some of our underspending is related to that. The other is around whether you want to call it savings or not. It still is part of us not spending our budget with the training. And we don't host any conferences overseas. The conference that we host locally, or workshop we hold, is local, and it's with the tribunal members and the researchers and sometimes the registry staff. But previously what happened is we held it in a location outside of Pretoria, so maybe in the Magaliesburg or somewhere, which meant that then people that lived in Joburg and Pretoria might have had to spend the night there. So this year we chose to hold it in the Sheraton Hotel at Pretoria, which meant that people just came in daily and attended the conference, and it we had a savings there, not paying for that accommodation. And then our training is driven more, instead of saying we want to spend X on the number of training things, we say we determine up front each year what conferences people are going to attend or what workshops they're going to attend and who's going to attend. That's on from the overseas side. And then local training, we aim to give everybody in the tribunal at least an opportunity once throughout the year to go on some local course that would assist them with the work that they're doing. And the people that go overseas are the tribunal members and then the researchers. And there are various, the reason they go overseas is because we're part of the International Competition Network, so there are those conferences that they need to attend and the OECD meetings. And then there are normally a number of workshops around mergers and cartels that are in environments where researchers can learn about merger activity and cartel activity and other competition matters. At overseas conferences, our local training is mainly around administrative staff, things like computer courses, maybe corporate governance and PFMA, those kinds of training. So that's where it happens. And I think our particular saving was around overseas, and that when we budgeted for the slightly more expensive tickets, and then we decided, okay, well, if we go on less flexible tickets, it can cost us at least 10 to sometimes even 20,000 Rand less for an overseas ticket. So I think those were where the savings were. In terms of capital expenditure, what happened with that is that we went out on tender and contracted with BCX to develop our case document management system. And in the budget we had provided, it was prior to the tender having been awarded and prior to us having any real idea of what the cost was of it was going to be and how to spread that cost over the period. We budgeted a certain amount, and the project started later than we'd anticipated because we spent a lot more time getting the tender documents together and going through the process. So there was a delay in that, and that we did pay BCX some of the money, but a lot of it has been laid over till this year because it was phase-driven, so we didn't pay them if the phase wasn't finished. We did, in our MTF submission, point out that we had underspent on that, and we have asked for a rollover, but our rollover is based on our operating surplus, and that is only about 0.9 million, so it's not a lot of money. And we've written to Treasury and written via the EDD for that, and we await that request. That was just for the current operating surplus. We had accumulated surpluses from before. There was also some ongoing support in that capital budget that we had budgeted for, which of course we didn't spend because the project hasn't started, and the ongoing support will only continue when the project goes on. With regard to the personnel expenses, underspending there is not only related to the tribunal members, it's also related to the fact that we had some vacancies where people left unexpectedly, and it took us a while before we could fill those positions. And also part of it is that we budget X amount of salaries on performance bonuses, and then maybe the performance bonuses aren't as high in a particular year as the budget was. And with the tribunal members, we had budgeted a figure which was based on the staff increase, but the tribunal members' salary increases are guided by the increases that are awarded to the High Court judges, and they got, I think it was only somewhere in the region of 5% last year, as opposed to 7 or 7.5 that we had budgeted. This year we brought that down because we now know that the judges' salaries are not necessarily as high as that's awarded to the rest of the public sector. The space issue, it's not as severe in the tribunal as it is in the commission, in the sense that I think the commission is unable to perform part of its work due to lack of space, whereas ours is, we do have a space problem in the sense that we don't have an adequate meeting room that we can use for ourselves. We have a problem with our interns, and that when our interns come, there's no dedicated space for them. They have to sit in the open space. We don't have a location for part-time members who happen to be there for a long period working on a case and might need an office to work in during that time. The hearing space I don't think is compromised because we've got two hearing rooms that we can use at any point in time. And the other issue is storage, where we can, with cases, generate large volumes of files, which there's not sufficient space to put them because we have taken up our space with Zippos or office space, and that becomes problematic. We have been engaging with the department, whether it's the DTI or the EDD, on this matter probably for the last 3 or 4 years. And I don't think it's as easy as saying we can just move off the campus, because we do report to that department, and previously it was the DTR, currently it's now the EDD, and we need to liaise with them. It's also an issue around money, because if we want to move off the campus, it's going to cost us more money for premises, and if we don't liaise with the department about it, then we might be in a situation where we don't have money. I think also now they, from what I understand from the commission, and maybe they'll talk about it more in their own meeting, is that given all the issues that have happened with office space in the past, I think one's got to go through public works now, and when you go through public works, you need your DGs to sign off that they're happy with you looking for other premises, and you can nominate premises. So we are, I think, you know, fairly constantly in touch with the department, and mainly we follow on from the commission, because it's more an issue for them than it is for us. But if they do have to move, we will also have to move. And so it's an issue that we are constantly liaising with. And I know that the EDD did make a submission to Treasury on additional budget for the move, but they have said that doesn't mean that we can move off the campus. There have been lots of stories on campus as to who's moving off and whose space we're going to get, but they seem to change fairly regularly. So CIPRO was supposed to move off. It's now called CIPIC. They're still on the office. There's also some talk about maybe parts of the DTR people moving into different space, which would then free up space. But there's no conclusive agreement or notification that's been given to us. So it's an ongoing issue that we keep, I think probably at least every quarter we are talking about it with the powers that be. The leaving the tribunal, I think we've dealt with that. We don't have people who leave and then come back to the tribunal. What happens is that we, and particularly with research staff and case managers, is that they start in the tribunal and then they move on to the commission, because that's where there's more experience for them and more employment opportunities. So I don't think there's anyone that we've re-employed who left previously out of all our staff in the 12 years that we've been there. And as I say, we don't have a large turnover of staff. Then irregular expenditure, I agree that it is irregular expenditure. And the issue there that we discussed with the Auditor General was, it wasn't that we hadn't followed procurement processes. We had followed the procurement processes, and we had done correct evaluation processes. The issue was that we didn't note a deviation. So where we had evaluated transcription services and we had decided that this particular firm was offering a better service. We hadn't noted that given this, this was our preferred supplier, and it was the same with the legal firm. We had followed a procurement process and got them to do some work for us, but then we never noted that going forward we would retain their services. So we have and are making corrective action for all these issues, all the SCM compliance issues as well within the tribunal, and we just recently had to submit a letter to the Auditor General where Norman committed on behalf of the institution that we would address the issues that were raised in our audit report, which in our case were non-compliance and irregular expenditure. And we're now busy going through the process of ensuring that everything in our house is in order and getting ready to note any deviations that we may need to note and going out and re-evaluating a number of services and then making a recommendation based on evaluations for who we remain with for certain services. So I think those were the financial issues. Oh, the cash issue. I think that just really refers to the fact that none of our money is tied up in fixed deposits in anything. It's cash, either at the bank or otherwise it's with the Corporation for Public Deposits. That's where our surpluses are kept, because we are required by the PFMA to leave our money at the CPD unless we have an investment policy, but we've never acted on that investment policy because in general we found that the CPD interest rate is competitive and the money is secure there. There's no real risks attached with it there, and when we need it, it's accessible. If you give them a notice before 12 o'clock, you get it the next day. So it's not tied up in any long-term deposits or 32-day deposits or 24-hour call accounts. So it's either in the bank or in petty cash or at CPD.
So which bank are you banking with?
ABSA.
Any further questions? I guess thank you for saving time, because yes, we've gone out of the time allocated. But it was necessary that we get clarity on this issue. Otherwise, thank you very much, and I hope that you've noted all the issues raised by ourselves, and you will be looking into them. Otherwise, once more, congratulations and thank you very much for availing yourself. And all the best.
Cheers. Thank you very much to the members for listening to us and all your patience and your interest. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you very much. Members, thank you. And we can send the chance. We'll meet tomorrow at 10:30. Can we meet earlier tonight?